This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm pleased to be speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Bennis is the lead author of a new study entitled Paying the Price, The Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. It's a study put out by IPS and by Foreign Policy in Focus. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks very much, Matt. Good to be with you.
Great to have you here. Of all the costs that you enumerate in this report, which one is the gravest to your mind?
I think any time you try to weigh the cost of a war, it's the human costs that are the most severe. And while we're hearing a little bit of information these days in the U.S. about the numbers of U.S. soldiers that have been killed, we're not hearing much of the details, and we're hearing almost nothing about the numbers of Iraqis that have been killed.
What are the numbers that you have on hand?
The numbers that we have came from mid-June, which is when we went to press with this report. It was always a challenge to figure out what's the moment when we have to stop counting and go to the printer. But at that moment, which was June 16th, the numbers that we had were 836 dead American soldiers. Now, that number is now approaching 1,000. It's gone up very quickly in recent weeks. The number of wounded in combat is a little over 5,000. Now, what we're not hearing about is the number of non-combat incidents, non-combat injuries, non-combat illnesses, all of the things that are not included that are attacking U.S. soldiers in Iraq. And that figure is over 11,000. Now, if we compare that to the numbers of Iraqi civilians that have been killed, it's quite staggering, because if we take the numbers of, at the best estimate, which is a little more than 10,000 Iraqi civilians killed so far, that's 10 times the number of U.S. soldiers that have been killed. It's an astonishing disparity of figures. It's the estimated number is about 40,000 Iraqi civilians who have been wounded. And this is in a situation in which the Pentagon refuses on principle to track the number of Iraqi dead and wounded. We have relied on the work of the British academics in the Iraq body count team, who monitor the international press in many different languages from many different countries and try and cross-match reports so they can get as accurate a figure as possible.
The amazing thing to me, Phyllis Bennis, is that the American people don't get to see either side of these human costs. I mean, we rarely see the human costs of, we don't see the coffins coming home, for instance, and of U.S. soldiers, and we rarely see the pictures or the stories of the Iraqi civilians who are killed or wounded. Actually, some of the first views of that I got were on Fahrenheit 9/11, the Michael Moore movie. Why aren't we able to see these? Why isn't the media providing these images?
Well, I think we have to go a step beyond the media. The administration has made it virtually impossible for the U.S. press to get access to most of these images and most of this information. The infamous decision of the Bush administration to prohibit photographs, for instance, of the coffins coming home to Dover Air Force Base has had a staggering impact, I think, on people's perception of this war as clean, relatively painless. You know, there's just a huge amount of illusion that decision has helped to perpetuate. On the question of not showing the effect of it on Iraqis, that comes back to the decision to prohibit most filming during the major parts of the war, except to U.S. reporters who were willing to do this embedded thing where they join units of the U.S. military and essentially become part of the U.S. military, deliberately only able to film one side. We didn't have, in the main, people embedded on the other side to show us both sides. There were some individual brave reporters. Anthony Shadid comes to mind from the Washington Post, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his writings about the impact of the war on Iraqis. He spent time on the other side, as it were, among Iraqi civilians who were at the other end of these U.S. Missiles and U.S. rocket attacks. But he was the rare exception.
And right now, Phyllis Bennis, it would be possible for the media to go see the casualties of a U.S. attack on Fallujah or wherever it is sending bombs in and depict the human stories of the Iraqis injured and or killed, and yet we don't really see those very often.
We don't see very much of it. There have been a few, but I must say that in the few weeks since the so-called handover of sovereignty, this fake transition that the U.S. has orchestrated, and the coming into office on June 28th of the so-called Iraq interim government, there has been, on the part of the U.S. press, a very sharp decline in coverage of events inside Iraq in general. It hasn't gone away altogether, but my perception is that there has been a significant diminution in both the quantity and quality of that coverage. It's as if the journalists and particularly the editors back home are taking the lead, not for the first time, from the U.S. administration's claim that this is now an internal Iraqi matter. Iraq is now sovereign. The fact that we still have 140,000 troops, notwithstanding, Iraq is a sovereign country, as if you could be a little bit sovereign. You know, it's more or less like being a little bit pregnant.
And there's this illusion of sovereignty even beyond the 130,000 U.S. soldiers that are situated there, because isn't it true that Paul Bremer, who the U.N. envoy Brahimi called the dictator of Iraq, that Paul Bremer rammed through all sorts of laws right before he left town that pretty much dictate the contours of governance in the near term?
Absolutely. What Bremer left behind was 97 new laws, all of which were imposed just in the last few weeks before he got on the plane with what one of his own assistants called his tail between his legs and scurried out of Iraq in the dead of night, as it were, you know, in a very secretive way. He had imposed 97 laws that would be binding on this new Iraqi government, and they cover everything from capping the tax rate to 15%, low taxes comes to Iraq, to ensuring that Iraq's corporate regulations are designed for WTO entrance, to ensuring that foreign buyers can purchase all Iraqi infrastructure, corporations, companies. Everything is up for grabs, essentially, with 100% foreign ownership and 100% export of profits out of the country. The imposition in every Iraqi ministry of what they call Inspector General, who is an American advisor, who theoretically is accountable to the Iraqi interim minister of whichever ministry it is, but in fact, given the amount of money controlled by the U.S. authorities, the notion that any minister is going to seriously challenge what his or her American, quote, advisor suggests is ludicrous. These are the people who will actually be calling the shots. So it's a huge array of business-related and legal documentation that will be very, very difficult for the interim government to challenge, not least because one of the laws themselves states, and the interim government accepted this, that to change any of these pre-existing laws, there must be unanimity among the president, the prime minister, the two vice presidents, and a majority of the cabinet, which essentially ensures that it's virtually impossible to achieve.
I'm speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who just put out a report called Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. And even with this illusion of the handover of power, Phyllis, you still have people writing in places like the New York Times saying, we don't do empire here in the United States. Look, we handed over power. This is almost a conscious effort, it seems to me, to misread what's going on or to deceive the American public that actually the United States isn't interested in controlling what's going on in Iraq. Or is this just naivete on the part of the writer?
Well, I think it's a combination. There is certainly plenty of naivete even at this late date. But I think it is much more part of a deliberate campaign to convince people in this country, particularly in the run-up to the U.S. elections, that the U.S. war in Iraq was a, quote, war of liberation. You know, keep in mind that after the decline of other existing claims of rational reasons for going to war, weapons of mass destruction, uranium yellow cake in Niger, Iraq being connected to September 11, mobile biological labs, all of those things being proved false over and over again, they were left with nothing but the notion that Iraq was a dictatorship, Saddam Hussein was a dictator, we've overthrown the dictator, we've liberated the people, and here's the proof, we're turning over power to them, we're not holding on to an empire.
But it used to be, the rationale was a little more grandiose than that. Not only are we turning over power, we're installing democracy there. But that's pretty hard to sustain.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
It's easy to forget that. It's hard to sustain right now when Dr. Alawi, the guy who used to be on the CIA payroll for 15 years and may now be in deep cover as prime minister, has passed a law that gives him the power to declare martial law.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing that seems to be holding him back is the fact that it's not at all clear that the Iraqi military is capable of imposing martial law at this stage. He may need to wait another week or two.
Bush has said that it's possible that the U.S. forces will be the enforcers of martial law.
Oh, there's no doubt that they will. They're already doing that in some areas. There was an astonishing piece in the Washington Post indicating or describing a tank unit of the U.S. military going out in their tank to patrol the streets. And gathering up not only their rifle and machine gun nest for the top of the I guess it wasn't a tank, but like a one of those armored vehicles that isn't quite a tank, a semi-tank. And the other thing that this guy gathered up was an armload of baseball-sized rocks to throw back at the children who might throw rocks at this tank. So that is certainly underway. We also can see that kind of subversion of what we understand as U.S. control or not in the case of the so-called handover of Saddam Hussein to the so-called Iraqi court. In both cases, the handover of Iraq and the handover of Saddam Hussein, it was a fake transition, a fake handover. In the case of the court that has been established to put Saddam Hussein on trial, this is a court, of course, in which, number one, the U.S. maintains physical custody of Saddam Hussein, even officially. The court itself remains paid for by the U.S. The court director, Salem Chalabi, the nephew of Ahmed Chalabi, who was responsible for so much of the false information provided to the U.S. In the run-up years to the war, and who, of course, is wanted for massive embezzlement in Jordan, has an outstanding arrest warrant. In Jordan, his nephew, Salem Chalabi, who lived and practiced law for many, many years in the United States, is in charge of the court, and the court is being paid for and arranged by the United States, with U.S. lawyers choosing the charges that will be issued against Saddam Hussein, and the FBI playing the major role in the investigation, going through witnesses, going through documentation, etc. And there was an extraordinary example just a few weeks ago in one of the first cases that was heard by an Iraqi judge. In the first day or so after the so-called transition of power to this interim Iraqi government, you had a case in which a defendant was acquitted, was found not guilty, of an attack on a U.S. Military unit. And the verdict was read, the guy was supposed to go free. U.S. Soldiers stepped in and said, sorry, we're not letting him go. He's being returned to Abu Ghraib prison because, in our view, under the Geneva Conventions, we are not bound by Iraqi law, so we don't have to let him go, even though he was acquitted by the Iraqi court. I think this is the kind of sovereignty, so-called, that we're going to see.
Phyllis Bennis, do you think the trial of Saddam Hussein is being geared to fit the U.S. Election needs of George W. Bush?
I think that it's being geared for longer-term U.S. needs than just that. I think if they can prevent the trial from getting anywhere close to allowing the subpoenaing or the questioning of anyone regarding the involvement of early U.S. administrations, particularly the Reagan administration, and most particularly individuals like Donald Rumsfeld, who was President Reagan's special envoy to meet with and give support to Saddam Hussein during the years of the worst human rights atrocities committed by that regime, I think that will be sufficient for them in the run-up to the election. In the longer term, I think there's a concern at setting a model with this trial. This will be really the first war crimes trial in the world that the U.S. can love. It's outside the influence of the United Nations. It's not relying on international jurisdiction. It's solely under the control of U.S.-controlled Iraqis. And in that context, they can move very quickly to narrow the notion of what a war crimes tribunal can look like, and keep it to the very narrow question of what individually did the person Saddam Hussein sign off on in these crimes, and ignore the issue of who were the enablers, who was it that sold the Iraqi regime in the 1980s, the seed stock for biological weapons, who provided the targeting satellite information to ensure that chemical weapons were used with the greatest efficacy against Iranian troops. Those would be Americans. Those would be the U.S. military, the U.S. White House, the U.S. Commerce Department. And it's keeping that information out of the trial that will make it such a great hit in Washington.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Phyllis Bennis, the lead author of a new study entitled Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War. One of the costs that you itemize in this report, Phyllis Bennis, is the cost of making the United States not more secure, less secure. In what ways has the Iraq War made the United States less secure?
One of the things that the war in Iraq has done has been to transform Iraq into something it never was before, and that is a centerpiece of international terrorism. The very prestigious establishment institution called the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, one of the most notable military institutes in the world, was asked the question, what has been the impact of the Iraq War on al-Qaeda? And their answer was very clear, accelerated recruitment. So it has not made Americans safer. It has not made the world safer. It has not helped to end terrorism. The U.S. administration, of course, once they were outed with their supposed mistake in the publication of this year's version of the annual State Department Patterns of Global Terrorism report, a report that had indicated that 2003 had seen a significant decline in the number of terrorist attacks, and Bush administration officials, led by Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, had come forward and said with great glee, "Oh, this proves that the war in Iraq has helped in the war against terrorism." Well, just a few days later, it turned out that the numbers were absolutely wrong, and finally they had to be clarified, and Secretary Powell was forced to admit that, in fact, 2003 had seen the highest numbers of significant acts of international terrorism since these records began to be kept. So the level of threat to Americans, to others around the world, is very, very strong. And so when we weigh that against the cost of this war, the dollar cost among those costs, we have to do it in the context of the war not making us safer, but making us less safe.
Phyllis Bennis, what are those dollar costs?
The overall cost that we've spent so far is $151 billion. Now, when we were working on the report, we realized that it was sort of hard to conceive of how much money that is. No one's ever seen $151 billion anything. So we looked for examples of what else could we have done with $151 billion just to give a sense of the staggering amount of money we're talking about. What we found on the domestic side, that $151 billion could have paid for housing vouchers for 23 million homeless Americans. It could have paid for health care for a year for 27 million Americans without health insurance. It could pay the salaries of 3 million new elementary school teachers. It could put 20 million children into new Head Start slots, or it could buy fire trucks for more than 678,000 communities that have outdated fire equipment. If we look at it on a global level, it's even more breathtaking because the money goes so much further. If we had that same $151 billion to spend, we could have paid for food for half the hungry people in the entire world and an international comprehensive AIDS prevention and treatment program, and clean water and sanitation for the entire developing world, and childhood immunizations for every child in the global south.
Do you know how many people about would have been saved by that kind of expenditure?
Well, I don't have the numbers on that one, no, but I do know that if that kind of expenditure had been done instead of going to war, then we could really talk about using that money in a way that would make us safer.
Phyllis Bennis, talk a little bit, if you would, about the cost to international law, international institutions, the World Court, the idea of this International Criminal Court, the United Nations, all these institutions that had been built up since World War II to try to put at least the patina of legitimacy in international law upon the world stage.
Well, this has been, this whole arena of the international law side of things has been, we've paid a huge price with this war. The unilateral U.S. decision to go to war stood in violation of the U.N. Charter, and in doing so, it set a very dangerous precedent for other countries that might use the same opportunity that to say the U.S. did it, why shouldn't we, to respond militarily to some threat, whether it was real or not, that they would say has to be preempted. So this could become the precedent for India to attack Pakistan, for the Congo to attack Chad, for Peru to attack Colombia. You know, this could be used anywhere in the world, and the U.S. would be unable to say anything about it. The U.N. itself, of course, was undermined when the U.S. took the position that unless the U.N. violated its own charter and endorsed this war, it would be, quote, irrelevant, and in doing so, undermined the legitimacy and credibility of the U.N., particularly in its replacement of U.N. authorization with this notion of creating what they called coalitions of the willing, what we call the coalition of the coerced. This was something that has set, again, a very bad precedent in international law when, by doing an end run around the United Nations approval process, that is the only way that a war can be legitimate and legal, and instead creating these separate coalitions, it undermines the whole notion of the purpose of the United Nations itself. If we look beyond that at the level of international law, the human rights norms have been significantly violated. And again, it sets a terrible precedent for other countries. If we look around the world, the U.S. has made very clear to countries like Pakistan, Egypt, and others that are historic, serious violators of human rights, that no one will say a word about their human rights violations as long as they maintain their support for the U.S. war in Iraq. So the cost in the diminishing impact of human rights norms and human rights laws is a very serious one.
And that's the flouting of the treaty, the Geneva Conventions, the treaty against torture, the statute against torture that U.S. troops were committing at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Also, the United States has been shipping detainees off to some of those very countries you mentioned, Phyllis Bennis, for torture. And so that does seem to be deteriorating these international standards. We don't have a ton of time left. Tell me, where do you see things now? How are they going to play out in Iraq? The occupation is supposedly ending, and yet the insurgency shows no sign of ending.
The insurgency is aimed very much at the occupation, and despite the linguistic turns of phrases about the end of occupation, what we're actually seeing in Iraq is a perpetuation of the occupation. When you have 140,000 American troops and 20,000 other international troops and 20,000 unaccountable private military contractors all occupying a country not accountable to the government of that country, you don't have an end to occupation. You have a continuing occupation. It's not surprising in that context that the opposition, the resistance, the insurgency, whatever name we give it, has continued. In the last period of time, reporters from the Associated Press and elsewhere have been identifying the difficulty there's going to be in for U.S. troops to defeat this insurgency because it's not rooted in wanting to establish an Islamist government, as the U.S. likes to claim. This is not something linked to al-Qaeda. This is something that is trying to reclaim power within a secular Iraqi state from many different vantage points. Certainly some of them are Ba'athists wanting to regain lost power. Others are democratic forces who are outraged at the foreign occupation of their country. But as long as this continues, you have people like Anthony Cordesman, the noted hawkish military analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, saying that it will be impossible for the U.S. troops to defeat this uprising against the occupation because the target, whatever name is given to the government structures in Baghdad, the opposition is aimed at the U.S. occupation. And as long as that remains, I'm afraid we're going to see a continuation of this horrific level of violence.
So what do you advocate, Phyllis Bennis? What should people here in the United States who are concerned about the occupation and Bush's policy in Iraq want? I mean, is it just withdrawal, withdrawal now? And if so, then what happens to the people of Iraq?
That's the first thing, withdrawal now. Bring the troops home. we don't know exactly what will happen after that. We do know that the vast majority of the violence is aimed at the occupation, so we can assume that the vast majority of the violent opposition will be diminished with the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Now, does that mean that overnight Iraq is going to turn into Switzerland? Of course not. But it does mean that once the U.S. troops are out, the main cause of the violence will disappear. That's what we have to get people to understand. We're not talking here about abandoning the Iraqis to some future of violence. We're talking about getting Iraqis out from under the today, current, present of violence that exists because of the U.S. occupation. So ending the occupation has to be step one. Then we can talk about what role the United Nations might play, backed up by the Arab League, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, and the other regional organizations, to provide peacekeeping help, election assistance, development assistance, all of those things. But those things cannot and should not be undertaken as long as the U.S. occupation remains.
And how do you answer a very common sentiment that I hear a lot? You know, we made this mess, we ought to clean it up.
I think it's absolutely right, but we have to define what we mean by cleaning it up. Maintaining 140,000 occupying soldiers is not cleaning up the mess. The mess means that we take seriously our responsibility to pay for the reconstruction, to rebuild what we have destroyed, to rebuild people's lives from the nightmare of 13 years of economic sanctions that was responsible for killing so many even before this war began. We have a responsibility to pay for all of that. We have a responsibility to support United Nations initiatives and other international initiatives to implement that kind of a support campaign and to write the checks. But we have an obligation to stay out. Our troops only make it worse.
Mm-hmm. But you're not concerned, for instance, about internecine conflict in Iraq, civil war, and what could end up there, an Islamic fundamentalist state that takes rights away from women?
I am concerned about it. What we see now is that women's rights are being stripped away. Ironically, during the years of the Ba'athist regime, women's rights were among the most advanced in the Arab world. Yes, women also were political prisoners and paid the price of living in a dictatorship of that sort, absolutely. But in economic and social rights, in the workplace, in the academy, in government, in the technocratic fields, women's equality was taken for granted. It's being undermined now under this current instability. There is the danger that there would be a period of a much more repressive regime once again. And I think we do have an obligation as civil society to work with our counterparts in Iraq and, again, to support international and regional efforts to assure that that doesn't happen. But the notion that the United States, responsible for so much of the devastation in Iraq, somehow is in the right position to act as the guardian of the rights of Iraqis simply doesn't exist. It's simply a false claim.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
And Phyllis, how would a listener get a hold of that report?
The full text of the report is on the IPS website, which is www.ips-dc.org.
Phyllis Bennis' report is called Paying the Price, the Mounting Costs of the Iraq War.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.